Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
We go in and I'm trying to problem solve with him, and Edward comes in, strips naked, goes and takes a shower. I could not believe that.
All right, Jim, first of all, thanks for joining me. We are actually, believe it or not, in the Tennis Channel, what do we call it?
Booth.
The booth. Oh, my God, sorry. The Tennis Channel booth here in Washington, where you were calling the city open here.
This is my office for the week.
I know, it
nice
is.
Nice digs, good
yeah,
deal.
Yeah, pretty good. Yeah. It's actually great, too, because it's nice and quiet in here. Jim, I guess, I want to go back to the start. We all do that, right? I want to know how you sort of got into tennis. I mean, you're from Dade City in Florida. How did you get involved in tennis?
Pretty simply, my parents, when they got out of college, you know, tennis in the 1970s was a big craze in America. It was a big, celebrities were playing. You know, it was the era with Chrissy and Jimmy and Arthur Ashe and Billy. And, it was just a real popular thing for people to do socially. So that's what my parents did with their friends. They played a lot of mixed doubles in the public parks in Dade City, where we lived. There was no tennis club there, but we went to the public parks or the high school or the community college. And my sister and I, my sister's 2 years older than I am, and we would play with each other or go to the jungle gym, but eventually we'd want to do what our parents were doing. So that's how I got started playing tennis, is just simply seeing my parents do it. They were B-level tennis players, very good athletes, but not like proper tennis players that had played a long time. But we loved it as a family. We played it a lot as a family. It was a good activity. It was among many sports that we played together. We're a very outdoors family. So it was really organic. There was no plan or, idea that tennis professional was a proper path for a living. Frankly, we didn't even know about junior tournaments when we got started. It was just one of those really natural, fun discovery scenarios for us.
Were you doing any other sports?
Lots. I played organized baseball. My dad was a very good baseball player. He played at the University of Florida.
Is that how you got the back end?
Unfortunately. I was a good baseball player, and I had proper baseball technique, and unfortunately...
So you're a lefty when you play
lefty,
baseball?
Lefty. I throw...
That makes so much sense
right?
to me now.
So I throw righty and swing lefty.
Yeah.
And so does my brother. My brother played college baseball, my younger brother. And so unfortunately, I decided when I was toggling at sort of 7 and 8, toggling back between baseball season and tennis season and then back and forth, to kind of cut out the middleman so I didn't have to have two swings. I just kind of combined them. And that was a near fatal mistake.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I mean, it's so interesting for me when I do these podcasts. I often... get sort of a little bit of backstory, and some obviously I know you really well, but I never knew something like that. Yeah. Now, so it's so fun for people to actually discover, because it's also important for parents to understand it's not necessarily about sending them to an academy to begin.
Yeah.
I think what you're saying is that, as I feel the same way growing up, you have to love the sport as a kid. Mm-hmm. And if you can instill that in your child just by being an example of the joy of playing tennis, I guess that's important.
I think so many of us got into the sport because of our parents, because they were involved in it.
Well, my parents didn't play tennis at all.
So how did you get involved in it?
Well, it's my older brother. But okay. I think it's somebody in, your parents obviously can steer you in a certain way.
Sure.
But also for me, being Australian, I was the same. I played tons of sports. Mm-hmm. So I just happen to be good at that one.
Do you think that's healthier to play lots of sports?
100%. I think it's really important, especially kids, different hand-eye coordination sports, footwork sports. Yeah. I mean, baseball is not exactly, I wouldn't put that in a super athletic as far as...
It's hand-eye. It doesn't require any kind of endurance. It just requires really good hand-eye and speed to get around the bases. And,
yeah.
I mean, it does have some skill to it, just not quite as complete as something like basketball or or tennis or soccer or something like that. But yeah, I played organized soccer for a couple of years too, and I loved coming up and playing lots of different sports. I didn't specialize in tennis until I was 13, and that for me was the right fit. But I also have, I leave room for other people's paths too, because our path isn't the only path, of course. And,
totally.
And I see people like Andre and Pete and Michael, my peer group, that only played tennis. They didn't play other organized sports, and they came through and have had wonderful lives and careers too. And I don't know that they knew any different.
Yeah.
So
God, you four are so different, though, when you think about your personality. So I think that's also we'll get to them in a bit.
Oh, okay.
sure. But so you go from, you know, kind of public park playing tennis with your family to heading to the Bolotari Academy, which is certainly a whole different story, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that is organized tennis at its highest.
Yeah. Well, you know, I went to Hopman's first, right, in Largo. So Harry Hopman had an academy going over at Bardmore, and which is a little closer to where I lived.
Yeah.
It was about an hour away, as opposed to Bolotari's being an hour and a half. So that was the first academy that I went to, and I went over there and would go on weekends, and eventually did about a two-month stint over there at one point. And then I had a scholarship. Mr. Hopman was nice enough to offer one to us, and then it got rescinded, so I was back home. And that's
why did it get rescinded?
I don't know, but in any case,
do you ever want to know? Did you ever say,
I know,
hey,
I just
guys,
don't,
you know what I ended up doing?
I know, I just won't say on the podcast. I'll tell you offline.
Oh, that's fine.
But
I'll tell everybody.
You know some of the people involved. They're not Australian.
It's okay. I mean, I also have my story of one Australian Institute of Sport coach telling me that they weren't going to send me away because my results didn't warrant them doing so and paying for it. And my answer to them was, well, F you, I'm going anyway, I'm going to pay my own way. So, you know, I think it's important for people to actually hear that even players as great as you ended up being are pretty much, you know, sometimes given the Heisman, like the palm up, and saying you're not good enough.
It's healthy, actually, in a way, to not be, for me, in a way, it was healthy to not be told that I was destined for greatness, even though I was one of the best players in the state of Florida and in the nation. One thing that was really eye-opener for me, just as far as how life works, happened when I was 12 years old, and I was getting a lot of pressure in Dade City, where I live, to play the Little League All-Star Baseball Tournament, where they put the best players together and we compete against other cities and states, and, you know, it's a national competition, international actually. And so I didn't play the national juniors that year, and I had been a top 10 in tennis. So I'd been because they coincided in the summer. So I'd been a top 10 junior in America in the 12 and unders. This was my first year of 14s, and I didn't play, so my ranking dropped down to like 85 in the country as a first year, which meant that Fila, who was giving me free clothes, said, "No, we're not going to give you free clothes anymore." And that was heartbreaking at 12.
Yeah, I know.
Heartbreaking.
Free clothes, rackets.
The rug pulled out from underneath you. So that gave me a little bit of an understanding of how the world works, that it's not all roses, and that was healthy for me. It didn't give me a chip on my shoulder, just made me realize that you have to work hard and you got to keep doing stuff if you want to keep getting stuff.
Yeah, I think it's really important for everybody to hear that not everything's that easy, and as you said, and you were a top junior, but also you decided to play a sport that you wanted to play at that time.
Yeah.
So I think that's important for parents to hear as well. You don't necessarily have to put, if your kids want to do something else at that time, let them, because they're 12.
Yeah, like, you only get to be a kid once.
Exactly, so I'm glad that you said that.
Yeah.
All right, so you know, you go through Bolotari's, it's kind of, you know, it's a little cutthroat there. It's like, you know, it's mano a mano. It's like, who's the best? Who's getting Nick's attention? Blah, blah, blah. It's pretty well documented that, you know, you and Andre were there at the same time. How much did that influence you just getting better as well?
Big time. So I'd gone back home from Hopman's, where I was surrounded by great players that were better than me and older and all that stuff, and pros practicing as well, to being in Dade City and having to now drive 30 to 45 minutes after school both ways to find reasonable practice. And it was stressful on my parents, it was stressful on me, and I wasn't getting better. Mm-hmm. And I was working hard to get better, but I was getting passed by people. But somehow I conjured up a good result at the Orange Bowl, which was a pretty high-profile, it still is, a high-profile junior tennis tournament at the end of the year down in Miami, and I made the finals of the 14 and unders somehow, some way, and that got Nick's attention, and that got me a scholarship offer to come down there, and that was a real fork in the road in my life. I don't know what would have happened had I still stayed in Dade City and been having to grind out practices. I don't know where I would have ended up, but I know that being in that environment, which is a professional environment with really big strivers, pros that are showing you how they're doing it, best amateurs in the world, it was special for me to get a chance. And I chose to be there. I very much wanted to be there, which is the polar opposite of people like Andre. He wasn't the only one who was there against his will. And as a result, I really embraced everything that it offered, and I ate it up, and I got better in a hurry.
Yeah. So when you won, when you won at the French Open, you obviously had to play Andre. I mean, the chances of that happening, you know, looking at the next 10 years was pretty obvious. I mean, you two were two of the greatest players at that time, so it wasn't that big of a deal that you played in the final, but it was also, it was a little crazy because Nick had sort of taken over coaching Andre, and you were not part of the Bolitari system at that point.
Well, I was, actually. I mean, I was using one of his coaches at the time, Sergio Cruz. Okay. So that was kind of the conflict for me, the emotional conflict for me was that Nick was still supporting me. I was still training at the academy. But that was the fissure once he sat in Andre's box. And Court won the bull ring. The box is right behind the player chairs. I mean, you almost touch them.
So and Nick's voice is very easy to recognize.
Yeah. So that for me, I couldn't fathom this guy who had done so much for me. Yeah. Giving me a scholarship, giving me all these opportunities. I was traveling with one of his coaches that he was so visibly siding with Andre. For me, just didn't make sense. And, of course, I took it emotionally and I left virtually the next day and took his coach with me.
Yeah.
So, I wasn't mature enough to understand the business decision that he was making there, which I can now understand and have full clarity on.
Yeah.
And we have no bad bones at all, Nick and I. But, we did. I certainly felt slighted at the time. But he changed my life in a great way.
So you're obviously known as one of the hardest workers on tour. You know, when your first slam was the French Open, correct? Do you remember that match and that night?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it was awesome.
Yeah.
It was so good. I mean, the match was really intense. It had a couple of rain delays. I got off to a very slow start, finished late, and then it's a blur. You know, you've won majors. You know how kind of it feels like you're in working in warp speed at the time because there's just things that you have to do. And your world is changing, and you're not really sure why. I mean, you kind of understand it, but not fully at that point. So it was great. You know, I'm out with my coach and my agent, and USTA people were around. It was a blast. And you wake up the next day, and all of a sudden, people at the Today Show and Good Morning America want to talk to you, which is an alien concept.
Yeah.
So it was awesome. It was a lot. It was fun. It was scary. It was.
Would you have considered yourself at that time fairly shy, or were you
no, never? Because I left home at 14. Yeah. You can't really be that shy if you've got to go fend for yourself in an environment where you're one of eight boys, teenage boys, full of testosterone, staying in a small room. Shy is not going to cut it.
Yeah.
So no.
Do you think that sort of helped you after that? Is that Or I guess more the question is, because I haven't gone through that of winning majors in singles, and you wake up the next day and you sort of feel like, okay, the target's now on me. Was that a different experience for you? Even though it was such a crazy time for American tennis as well, with a lot of spotlight on a lot of players, but you were the first, I believe, of that group to win a slam.
Well, that we'd had a couple guys break through earlier, so that the guys that sort of foamed the runway for me, if you will, with Michael and Pete had already had success at a high level. Yep. Ironically, Andre, who was, the best of us at the youngest age, it took him a little bit longer to win majors. Of course, he would win eight and have an amazing career. But for me, it was – I was really lucky in that I think coming from a small town helped me process that, because I went back to that small town. Mm. And I went back and stayed at home at my parents' house for like 4 or 5 days. And that was good for me to get sort of stabilized and to understand who my core group of people were, because what changes, you don't necessarily change inside. What changes is what's happening around you and how people are viewing you. And that can change a person in that environment if you allow it to.
Yeah, and how many more friends you have all of a sudden.
Yeah, and then realizing who is your friend and who isn't is really important. So that I had a good core group of people and some parents who were still raising my brother, who's 11 years younger than me. So, they weren't at the tournaments with me every week. There was no pressure on that. Yeah. They were living their lives. My dad was working. My brother's in school. My mom's taking care of him. So, it was For an abnormal period of my life, I had a lot of normality, which was great.
So onto that rivalry with Andre, and you know, it's funny, sitting here in Washington, I'm actually directly looking at, you know, the champions here, 95 Agassi, 96 Chang, 97 Chang, Agassi.
Yeah.
You know, you think about Chang, Agassi, yourself, and of course Pete. That period of time, were you guys friends, or were you sort of like just, you know, in a locker room together, having to play against each other, but knew each other from juniors?
Well, I think it moved around a little bit. Yeah. I think that when we started off, Pete and I, we'll take it way back, Michael and I roomed together on Junior Davis Cup, so we traveled all summer as juniors, staying in the same hotel room one year.
Yeah.
Pete and I were doubles partners the first year that we were out on tour together. Until he won the U.S. Open, we played a lot of doubles together and basically ate all the meals and practiced a ton together. Andre and I had spent the time at Bolitari's, and then we'd all end up playing Davis Cup together at various times through our careers.
What a crazy team.
Being at Olympics together and things like that. So, you know, I don't think there was ever any moments where anyone was remotely getting close to a fist fight. You know, I think we're all relatively respectful of each other and friendly and you know, for the most part. So, no, I think it was an amazing time. And of course, there's tension when you're trying to compete for the same things and you're basically fighting for each other's lunch money. In a way. Although we were lucky enough to have plenty to offer, thanks to Billy and, you know, Arthur and all our forefathers and foremothers who paved the way for you and me to live this amazing life. But it's nice to look back now and to be able to talk to those guys now and through the lens of we came through it together.
Yeah.
So it's been pretty special.
Pick one of those guys to go on a deserted island with and hang out with for a week.
Well, Andre's probably the most... he's the biggest seeker, I would say. So if you want to have conversations about lots of different topics, Andre is probably the broadest.
Yeah.
And you know that as well. You spend time because you're obviously tight with Steph. So, you know, for conversations, you know, Andre is awesome. I mean, you're not going to get nicer people than Pete or Michael. You're just not. I mean, they're not going to say anything bad about anyone. Pete, I mean, he's got a sly sense of humor when he's in the locker room or at the golf club or whatever. And Michael is kind and generous and thoughtful as you'll find.
Yep.
So it just depends on what mood I would be in. Is what am I looking for?
That's true.
You know, what if you want to have, you know, some raucous discussions, you probably want to bring in AA.
Yeah, yeah. I just want to know when you guys get into a conversation, who speaks the most? Because you're both so philosophical and really, I mean, you're really deep thinkers, the two of you.
Well,
you and Andre.
Well, thank you. I think.
No, I mean, it's actually a compliment, believe it or not. I mean, I know you're used to me giving you shit.
I am. Oh, we can say shit on
you. Yeah,
okay.
It's a podcast, man. You can say whatever you want.
All right, just
we drop F-bombs and all kinds of stuff.
All right,
stuff.
Well, I'll try and keep it relatively clean. Look, Andre and I don't speak that frequently, but when we do, I like to hear what he has to say. I know what I'm thinking. I know what's in my head, so I'm trying to listen more and see what I can glean from him and figure out, because he's surrounds himself with some really interesting people, and he has a lot of different takes and interesting angles that I like to hear.
Yeah.
So I try and listen more than speak there.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you, particularly him, he got to that point as well, right, in his life, because he certainly wasn't like that early on. I want to go back to one match at the Australian Open when Pete puked in that match. What goes through a player's mind, particularly you who knows Pete? This is an incredibly high-stakes match.
Yeah.
And you see someone throw up. What was the first thought in your head?
Well, I think you might be conflating two matches, right? Because Pete threw up against Karecha
at the U.S. Open.
He had the tears.
At the Australian Open. Yeah. What was that moment like?
I mean, I've had players throw up on the court against me.
We had one the other day actually throw up.
Really?
The poor guy had to default five ball in the third. But I'll show you the video later.
Not good.
But, that match against Pete when he was crying, he just lost his coach, Belly. I mean, it's a very strange moment for you, I'm sure, because it was a hugely important match.
It was, but we also knew what was going on off the court. Pete and I had been at dinner the night before together at a table with Tom and Tim Gullickson, who were, at the time that we played the match, the next night on a plane flying back home to Chicago to try and figure out exactly why Tim kept having these seizures and what was...
So you and Pete had dinner.
Pete and I,
the night before your match.
Paul Anacone, who was going to step in and take over for Timmy G in the meantime, we all, with Ian Hamilton of Nike, we all went out together. And, you know, we went and visited, Brad Stein and I went and visited, who was my coach there in Australia. Mm-hmm. We went and visited Tim at the hospital before they left. Like, we're a close-knit bunch, you know. And, of course, we want to win the match. Of course, Pete and I know what's at stake. Yeah. You know, of course, we know all of this stuff. But we also knew that there was something bigger and more sinister in play, and that that was bringing a lot of darkness to the match. So he struggled. I mean, he was very clearly struggling with his emotions, which he's always bottled up prior to that point, and he just couldn't take it anymore. And the fans were trying to be supportive of it, and they sort of broke him down, and he started crying, and it certainly became a memorable match. It was the level of tennis was excellent. I think it would have been memorable just on the tennis alone for me.
Yeah.
But that just added a new element to it of awkwardness and darkness to it. And I remember after the match, I had a friend of mine who hadn't seen a lot of tennis, who was an entertainer, who I gotten tickets to the match. He was in town playing with his band, and he came into the locker room afterwards, and Pete and I were both on training tables next to each other like you do. You know, and we're both cramping, and we're both sort of just talking to each other. And he, I went to dinner with him the next day. He goes, "Do you guys like do that? Do you talk to each other after matches like that?" He's like, "I couldn't possibly. How do you do that?"
Oh, the entertainer was saying, "How do you do that?"
Yeah, he had no concept of how combatants could actually then just go talk about it afterwards and be next to each other. And you know, if you're not from the world, it's just a very foreign concept because most team sports, obviously, that doesn't happen.
No.
The tennis is
they'd rather
is
kill
different.
Each other.
Tennis is different, so you know that's something that.
Wait a second, though. Let me just stop you there, because tennis is different, but there are also times where there's been times where I know players would rather be on the other side of the world than next to their opponent and not talk. So we don't want to give everyone this rosy that everyone's like that. I would say a lot.
That's fair.
I would say a lot.
I've seen a few people pinned up against a locker before, but
So
but I'm not throwing anyone under the bus, Mark Knowles, but you know.
No, but it's true. I mean, it is an interesting dynamic that in the locker room, everyone's in the locker room.
Yeah.
Like, literally, I think one of the funniest things for me is, like, US Open, you know, the champion's locker, and you could have the entire locker room available.
Mm-hmm.
The entire locker room. And you have the two people in the final, and they have the lockers right next to one another, and they refuse to move during the tournament.
Right.
Instead, so they're getting showered and dressed within 3 feet of one another.
Yeah.
And it's just like, can't change anything. Did you have any weird superstitions, actually?
Superstitions? Not really.
No. Didn't have your Rafa bottle?
I mean, I had rituals. Like, I wanted to, you know, ball, when the deuce court, I'm taking the ball from the ball kid on that side and add court the other side to expedite. But no, I wasn't
overly
superstitious.
Was it to expedite, or it was like that was your thing?
Well, it was my thing, but, and I didn't like it when one of the ball kids didn't have the ball when I wanted them to, but, you know, I'd use the other one, and if I lost the point, I blamed it on the ball kid. No, I'm kidding. But, you know, you just get used to things that, I think the reason that I had the rituals, and I suspect it's the reason that you did, and we all have our little things on the court, is because it makes us comfortable when we're traveling the world doing different things in different cities. That's our home office, and it makes us feel at home in a stressful environment.
Yeah.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Come on, come on. Okay, so you have this incredible rivalries and these amazing moments, and it was an incredible decade, particularly for American tennis, when you talk about you and Pete and Andre and Michael. Cut to, 20 years later and what we're seeing now with Roger and Rafa and Novak.
Mind-blowing.
Yeah. I mean, explain that, because you were in the midst of such an incredible sort of decade there in the 90s. What are you seeing now?
Well, first of all, they're just amazing athletes. The level of athleticism, their professionalism, their dedication, their understanding of scheduling. There's so much that they do right that leads them to the success. And they have a circumstance where the surfaces have become more homogenized, which allows them to play a similar style across all surfaces, and there are fewer surface specialists than there were back in the day. And I don't know if that's why they're more consistent. It might have something, a very small piece of it, but they're far more consistent than any of the great players in my generation were. You would see top players take early losses, and it wouldn't blow your mind. Now, if you see these guys lose early in a major, like when Stakovsky beats Federer at Wimbledon, you're like, oh, my God, the world's ending. You can't believe this is happening.
Yeah.
But the thing that I think separates them from the other great players is their defensive capabilities, because most of the great players historically are offensive-minded players.
Pete had the serve and the forehand.
Yeah. You look at that, Pete, if he's having a good day, absolutely unbeatable. And he had far more good days than bad days. But on bad days, he was vulnerable.
Yeah.
And these guys, if they're having a bad offensive day, they just fall back and play defense. Mm. And they play such high percentage tennis. They know how to manage their games. And they've shrunk the bandwidth of their good and bad days to a point that it's almost a flat line. They just rarely have these days where, I can think of Novak playing Gilles Simon in Australia and making 100, literally 100 unforced errors in a 5-set match, and he still won.
Yeah.
He still managed to find his way through the worst day he's probably ever had in tennis that I've seen him, as far as that statistic goes, like by far, he still found a way to win. These guys are just so good at managing all the elements that are in play. And they're playing with, the margins are small. The game's faster than it's ever been. There's less reaction time than we had in between shots, for sure.
Yeah.
But they're awesome. They're amazing ambassadors. And it just boggles the mind to think that we waited so long for someone to clip Emma's 12 majors in men's tennis.
It's incredible.
And then Pete gets to 14 and walks off after he wins the Open. And you're like, well, that's never going to get beaten.
Yeah.
And then there are three guys
from
the same era.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
I know this is an impossible thing to ask, but I mean, I'm going to be, just because I'm
Well,
that
the
person.
Impossible burger seems like it doesn't work too, but it does.
Well, yeah, it's true, but I own that stock, so I'm happy with that. Tell me about, if you had to sort of take a run at it right now, who do you think is going to have the most of those three?
The easy money would be on the guy in the lead right now, because you just don't know who's going to get injured. So Roger, Roger sitting at 20, right now, that's probably where the betting line should be, just because of the injury factor. But I suspect that when it's all said and done, if injuries are not a huge part of the discussion going forward for Rafa and for Novak, that Novak's going to have the most.
Yeah, I think that's the consensus for a lot of people. I agree with you with the injury thing. We can't ever understand or look what happened to Novak for those couple of years, with the elbow. And
that's right.
Rafa with the knees.
Yep.
I think it's going to be an ongoing issue. And, look at what Roger did. We thought he was all done like 5 years ago with the back. So you never know. But I think the betting money would be, if I had to put it on,
that's for you too,
Novak. For Novak but I think the Wimbledon final actually was a precursor on why.
Well, it was huge.
Because I think if Roger had got 21, that might have been close to being unsurpassable. But I don't know. I think now that Novak's the guy to beat.
Yeah, well, just think about it. I mean, he's 5 years younger than Roger, I believe, something like that, and 5 or 6. So he's got, if he stays healthy, and he seems to be taking great care of his body, so he probably has another 20 looks at majors.
Yeah, and that's,
and he's great on all surfaces.
Yeah.
So I think it's not unrealistic to think that he can win 5 more.
So, when you
but
think
that's
about,
saying that Roger doesn't win anymore, too.
Of course,
there's so many variables here.
Yeah, there's a lot of variables, but Roger's, not getting any younger, as they say. Father Time does catch up to everybody.
It's undefeated.
Speaking of Father Time, retirement, back to you. What was the catalyst that you said, all right, Jim, it's time to hang it up?
It was one specific...
And how hard was it, or how easy was it?
So it was easy. It was one specific match. I was playing... It was one specific tournament, I should say. I was playing in San Jose in February, you know, the indoor swing in the States after Australia. And I made it out to the semis, and I played a young Aussie, talented Aussie, Mark Philippoussis. And Flip and I are battling in the semifinals on a Saturday, and we've got a great crowd in the arena. And I lose a close match, and I walk off the court, and I just didn't feel the sting. And that's when I knew I needed to let someone who felt the sting take that spot. You know, I'd done everything that I could in my career to be ready to play every day. And for me, not feeling what I needed to feel on the court.
Which was pissed off.
Well, yeah. You got to feel something.
Yeah.
And not having that pang of regret after the match, I just wanted to go home.
Yeah.
And then when I wanted to go home, that's when I knew I needed to stay there and find something else that made me want to leave.
I think it's really important for people to understand what's the motivator. And some people have very different motivations. Some just the injuries physically, they can't do it. Sometimes, I want to have, especially with women, you know, I want to have a family, so, and I'm not motivated anymore to do this. I'm not motivated to travel, be away from my family. Or, you know, yours is like, you know, it didn't sting for me. Then you start to go, why am I doing this anymore then? And being away from my family and putting myself through hell, because you had to physically play.
It's a big lift. And I couldn't do it halfway. I just don't have that in my personality to mail it in. And I didn't think it was right to go out there and take a spot on tour if I wasn't impassioned. And I also knew
how
much
work. And you're not bombing down 120, 140 mile an hour serves, winning easy points.
No, there's that too. But even people who did that ended up finding that it was a lot. And that, you know, Pete was able to win without having to really grind. And even for him, it just became a lot. And I get that. And I admire the players who have managed their schedules better than we have and are doing so many great things for themselves and especially for the sport. You know, having our stars stay in the sport so much longer now is so valuable for tennis. Is it tougher on the younger players to break through? Absolutely. But for the long-term and immediate health of the game, if you can have, say, hey, Coco Gauff, you don't have to come out and grind right now. This doesn't have to be the apex of your career like a Martina Hingis. You have until, I mean, look at what Venus and Serena are doing. Mid to late 30s, you can still be winning majors.
If you say that to the kids now, they're like, there's no way I'm going to be playing in my 30s. I mean, because Serena and Venus both used to give me shit for still playing on the tour in my late 30s. And I'm like, excuse me? Hello? Who's still playing?
Yeah.
I think it's about what you're talking about. If you still have the passion to put yourself through the grind and through the stress, because it's stress, and particularly when you're a great player, the expectation is to always win. So if you can put yourself through that consistently and be okay with it, that means you still have the passion to play.
And I think one of the things that helps players keep that passion is taking good breaks and scheduling properly. And one of the reasons that I suspect Andre was able to play into his mid-30s at such a high level was that he took a lot of time off for various reasons during his 20s. And that gave him a second wind to go. That's something that Michael and Pete and I didn't do. We just kept grinding, tournaments, exhibitions. You know, it was a never-ending calendar. And you know, knowing you can't go back and uncork time. But if you knew... You know, seeing what players do today, and be like, yeah, of course I'm going to take a month off after the U.S. Open.
What's wrong with that?
After Australia, I'm not going to go to Dubai and Europe. I'm going to relax, rest, and get another training block and be at home and be fresh and then go play.
So you think it's a good thing that someone like Coco, that the WTA has that age eligibility rule?
Yeah, look, I'm conflicted in a way because I do believe that I don't believe in the rules in some of the team sports where you, like, if you're good enough to play in the NFL, you should be able to go play, especially a sport like that where the lifespan of those athletes is so small. And to give up some of your good years to play in college for free, I'm not a big fan of that. But I think guardrails are good, and I don't think that, was it 15 events that she's able to play?
I should know.
I'm learning about it through her success. I don't think that's a bad thing because she can also play exhibitions and world team tennis, and there are other ways for her to still compete and get matches that are going to make her better. But she should be, and it's a good thing also, in my opinion, that she has the counsel of Tony Godsick and Team 8, who have managed Roger's career
Beautiful.
From a scheduling standpoint as well, fantastically, and they can point to that.
Yeah.
And that's she is a great role model. Hmm. And then she's on the inside for that. So I think it's fine.
She's playing an exhibition actually with Ash Barty in about a month.
Yeah,
prior
Winston?
To the U.S. Open. So yes.
Yeah, Winston-Salem.
So yeah, you're right. I mean, she's still going to get exposure. Yeah. Still going to be playing great players. And I've always said now, tennis is not a sprint; it's a marathon.
Yeah.
It used to be in our day a more of a sprint.
Right.
Sprint to 30, hang on for a couple of years maybe.
Yeah.
Now it's like no marathon through till about mid 30s. Now with the money, people obviously that make a good living can certainly have a great team around them.
Correct.
Just quickly, I want to get into your broadcasting. Like, how did that happen? I mean, obviously, you and I are quite loquacious, so it's not exactly difficult to get into. But
I don't think I was known as being that way when I came off tour, though. But it happened serendipitously. You know, I had a pretty chilly relationship with a lot of people in the media.
Yeah.
You know, because I got burned in some early stories and wasn't mature enough to sort of separate a couple of bad eggs from the whole carton. So I could be a little tough in press conferences.
Salty.
Yes, very salty, indeed. Sea salty, even.
Sea salty.
But so what happened was I retire at the same time that TNT, a network in America, got the rights for Wimbledon away from HBO. And they needed a team, and they didn't have anyone. And people at IMG who were managing me at the time said, hey, is this something you would be interested in doing? I said, yeah, I've been hanging out in Orlando for a few months. It's been fun, but yeah, I mean, it'd be nice to see some friends, and I'll try it, see if I like it. And it dawned on me that I didn't know anything about it, so I was very nervous going into it.
Mm-hmm.
And it dawned on me that I shouldn't be starting at Wimbledon. I should probably be starting at a very small tournament somewhere where no one's listening, so I can learn how to do this. But I was lucky enough to be surrounded by some amazing people both behind in the truck and next to me in the seat. I got to work with Mary Carrillo. I got to work with Marv Albert. We just had an amazing group of professionals. Ernie Johnson was our man on the desk, who's incredible.
There you go.
I mean, we were just it was a padded room for me.
Yeah.
So I couldn't really hurt myself too badly, and it was an amazing start and an experience, and I've kind of just done it ever since.
Tell people what it's like.
What was your first?
I actually, to be honest with you, I did my very first broadcast when I was 18.
Whoa.
In Australia. Gary Wilkinson, who's a great Australian broadcaster for many, many years, jokingly said to me, what do you want to do when you're done? I said, Gary, I'm only just starting my tennis career. Like, don't throw me under the bus yet. And I said, I don't know, maybe when I'm done I'd like to do what you do. Kind of as a joke. And he said, well, why don't you come in and sit and do a match with me tomorrow? And, you know, me being so stupidly naive and ballsy at the same time, I was like, all right. And literally that was my first match. It
awesome.
Was Nicole Pratt played Sabine Appelmans in Brisbane. And my first
awesome.
Thing was on camera. So, I didn't know any better. So I just sort of ran with it. And, you know, I throughout my career actually spits and spats did Eurosport, Australian TV, and
smart.
Then ESPN, and then Tennis Channel, and now...
You know,
all over the place.
So your first thing was an on-camera. So my first thing was to interview my peers before the tournament. I had to do sit-down interviews with Andre and Pete.
Oh, how difficult
was
that?
They came over to my rental house. We set the cameras up over there. It was brutal. I was sweating bullets. It was awful.
They were
so kind. Of course they are. They're like
actually,
laughing. Like, this is ridiculous.
Kind of good in some respects because at least you knew them. It wasn't like these superstars looking at you going, who the hell are you?
They were going to take care of me, but we're all in on the joke. Like, how is this real? Like, well, what are we doing here?
Well, at least you knew good questions to ask them.
I was terrible. I'm sure I was awful.
No, I'm sure you were great.
Not. I promise you.
Last couple questions, because I know you're busy and you got to go, and I really appreciate your time. But when you look at tennis now, and you're now in the broadcasting, you're running the Old Farts, the Legends Tour.
We call it the Invesco Series.
Yeah,
but
there you go, the Invesco
you're,
Series.
You're down the right idea. You got the right idea.
Is that fun for you to be around still and play these guys?
I love the way that I've figured out a way to stay in the tennis world.
Stay in shape. You're still in great shape.
And it's a great reason to stay in shape when you know you've got to compete and it's going to be televised. It's sort of your ego sort of says, I better practice and I better stay with it and I want the clothes to fit and all that stuff. Right?
Some aren't.
Right?
Some aren't doing the work, but a lot are. I'm actually impressed with you guys when I see you
thanks.
Week in and week out. I'm like, God, how do you still do this?
Yeah, it's fun. I mean, it's I never, even when I was tired of the grind, when I'd retired, I was still, so I was living in Orlando, where I still have my house and still live. And Pete was training out of the same place, and Pete came back after like Miami, and he needed someone to hit with. And I was retired, literally had stopped. I didn't even told anyone that I was retired. And so I went out and hit like 2-on-1s with Pete all week. You know, it's not, I never lost the love for actually hitting the tennis ball. It was just doing everything else that and getting on the plane.
Yeah.
You know, it's a great line that the bass player from ZZ Top says is, they don't pay me to get on stage, they pay me to get on the bus.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's so true. Yeah, it's a good way of thinking about it. So are you going to get your kids in tennis, or are you just going to let them do whatever they want?
So I have a 2.5 and a 4.5-year-old boys, and they have their little rackets. And we've got the foam balls, and we play tennis in the house because the foam balls are fine.
Yeah.
And my 4.5 is, you know, takes little semi-private lessons with his best friend. So we get our club pro down in Orlando, gives him a 30-minute lesson once a week when we're there. And he's good. He likes it, and it's fun, and we don't do it too much.
Yeah.
You know, and basically wait for him to ask if he wants to play. And then that 2.5-year-old just follows him around and can barely pick the racket up, so he drags it around. He's almost playing more golf with the tennis racket.
Yeah, it's fine.
But it's great.
It's just seeing it.
Yeah.
It must be amazing for you.
Yeah.
See,
you know, my wife played college tennis, and she played the Futures and Challengers and stuff, so we're a tennis family.
Susanna.
So
let's give her a shout-out.
Susanna's the best.
Yeah.
She has far better technique than I do.
Maybe on the back end.
For sure. Well, on the forehand, too.
Oh, well. Yeah. We've got to see that. Well, maybe I can play with you guys. Up in New York, I can hit
you
some
can
balls
do it.
With Susanna. I need someone to play with when I'm up there.
Yeah,
so.
Well, we'll be there for you.
Yeah, yeah. God, there's so many questions I want to ask you, but we got to go. But I guess one question I want to know, is there one match or one point where you were just like, I just can't even believe this is happening?
One match or one point where I can't believe is, yes. The first final I ever made. You always remember your first final, right?
So on the ATP or on the Slam?
On the ATP.
Uh-huh.
So the ATP. I was playing in Basel. I was playing Stefan Edberg in the final. And at that time, the final was best of five. It was 2 out of 3 until the final. So a couple things that I can't believe. So there was also back then, after the third set, there was a 10-minute break automatic. So we split the first two sets. He wins the third set, and we go in. And you can talk to your coach and all that.
Yeah.
So we go in, and I'm with my coach, you know, the guy from Balotelli's I would leave with later. And we go in, and I'm trying to problem solve with him. And Edberg comes in, strips naked, goes and takes a shower. I could not believe that.
Oh, my God.
Can you imagine? Like, he goes and takes a shower. Tony Pickard, his coach, is just kind of sitting there sort of ho-humming. I'm like, this is great. I'm going to win this fourth set. He's in there combing his hair and putting on deodorant afterwards.
I mean, he did look good.
He looked great. Stefan still looks
great. That's why he looks so good. He actually went and had a shower.
He went and had a shower.
Brushed his hair.
And I won the fourth set 6-0.
No, come on.
Yeah, yeah. So I won the fourth set 6-0, and then somehow I scrambled and scraped to a 7-5, and the fifth set win.
That's a
classic.
But
it was, I mean, the shower, right? Can you, I was like, who does this?
I guess a lot of people.
I guess I was a 19-year-old kid. I was like, maybe this is what you're supposed to do. Maybe if I get here, I'll do this next time.
Not when you won the set 6-love. You're like, hell no, I'm not taking a shower ever in between a match.
Yeah, yeah.
Really? Did you never take a shower in between? Even when rain delays?
Well, rain delays, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
You didn't think
should
I be doing
not if
this?
You only have 10 minutes. You're going to blow 5 of it on a shower and change? I mean, no, I want to talk to my coach, and I'll change a shirt. I mean, I might change my clothes, but I'm not getting a shower.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Sorry, Stefan. Shouldn't have taken a shower.
Shouldn't have done that, but damn your hair, man. I'd never worn a hat if I had hair like yours.
He still looks good.
He's a handsome fella.
Yeah, he is. Yeah. Anyway, Jim, thanks so much.
Thanks, Dubsy.
Carry on here in Washington, and
likewise.
I'll see you continually on the road. And to people that don't know Jim, he is the real deal. He's a great guy, and I'm going to talk about you later. So
okay,
I
good.
I want to do that for you, because I'm already embarrassing. I mean, you're already a redhead. We don't need to make you a red face.
I got that, too. They can't see the money that's coming under the table right now.
Yeah, bullshit.
All right, thanks,
Jimmy.
Okay.
And that's it for this episode of the Racket Magazine podcast. Thanks for listening. Our host is Renee Stubbs. Our co-host and producer is me, Caitlin Thompson. Music by internationally renowned DJ Stretch Armstrong. Thanks to Tim Rogerian and the team at Acast. Find us at racketmag.com/podcast and subscribe to us at any of your favorite podcatchers.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.